Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carl saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. We put on events in spaces and venues of all sizes around the country where people tell stories and talk about stuff. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. 2016 was a hell of a year and it's one which requires not one but two podcast reviews. Next week we'll turn our attention to the big news stories of the year, but this week it's our review of the year in culture and arts and our first broadcast from our now annual trip to Other Voices in Dingle County, Kerry. Over the course of the first weekend in December, we were joined by some mighty people by the fire in the back room of Foxy John's to talk about a whole host of things from Russell Carl Kelly to psychosomatic illnesses. This week, it's the turn of Etna Shortall, the chief arts writer at the Sunday Times and the author of the soon-to-be-published debut novel Love in Row 27, to run the rule over the arts and culture highlights and lowlights of 2016. Here's Etna on the books, films, music, theatre, TV shows and much more of the last 12 months. Dingle, it's Foxy John's and it's Banter. So welcome back. If you were here yesterday, you know what was involved. It's great to see you all here bright and early as well. My name is Jim Carroll. I'm the host of Banter Sessions and it's a pleasure to be here in Dingle for the 50th year in a row. Today we have a galaxy of great people for you to meet. We start right now with... Roll the drums. Drums. Please give a warm welcome to the Sunday Times chief arts writer and soon-to-be-published debut novelist, Etna Shortall.
Thanks.
Welcome to Banter.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm good. My last banter, which actually wasn't that long ago, was talking about the struggle of buying a house, so this is much nicer.
Have you given up looking for a gaff?
Yeah, pretty much giving up. So
okay,
after
right.
a year, this is depressing enough. So.
Okay, let's start with the elephant in the room. Congratulations on the book deal. How did you manage to keep writing a book quiet for so long?
It was quiet publicly or whatever, but like my kind of close friends and stuff knew about it, but mainly because I was scarlet. So if it didn't work out, which was very possible, I would have been very embarrassed, so I didn't tell anyone, which is basically it. And I got an agent, my agent's in New York, and we did our first publishing deal in the UK, and I really didn't want it to be in Ireland. I didn't want it to be about my job and the fact that I write about books. Also, when I write about books, it's which isn't my main thing, but it's usually literary fiction, whereas I'm writing commercial fiction, hopefully. Because I always think if you say commercial, that means lots of people have to buy it for it to actually classify. But so it's a different genre of book as well. So it was, I just wanted a bit of separation between church and state.
Okay, right. So the reason we're here today is talk about the arts review of the year, the kind of the cultural roundup. And I mean,
yes,
you've written, you write about lots of different sort of cultural forms for the Sunday Times. And one of the areas you've written about a lot, but this year you kind of gave up on it was theatre.
Mm.
Well, like, was there any reason why you decided to kind of stop writing about theatre?
Yeah, well, like, I mean, I'm still doing interviews and columns and stuff, but I was the theatre reviewer for the paper for about 6 years. But, like, I was seeing 100 plays a year. Like, that's a massive amount of theatre, massive amount of anything. And we calculate the time and, like, it was just a lot. And the book was part of it as well. Like, I have a second book now to write and I don't have any time off, so I want my evenings free. But, also, like, when I first started doing theatre reviews, I loved it. Absolutely loved going and was really excited by theatre and would, like, be waiting the new season programmes of everything. And then it becomes a chore. I realised the Dublin Theatre Festival had just gone, that I, like, was sort of dreading it, you know. And it's not a reflection on the calibre of theatre. It's just you get jaded. And I think a lot of critics get jaded and they don't stop what they're doing. They just keep going. And I don't think that's good for them or the art form or the people that are reading. And I just start to feel that kind of tiredness. So I thought it was time to
Give
it up.
But like, it's interesting you say that about, like, what, like, I mean, going to see 100 plays a year. Years ago, I went to an awful lot of theatre because my housemate at the time was a theatre critic. So I was dragged along.
I was the plus one
to keep it the same. And I saw some absolutely awful shite. But I saw some amazing stuff in the middle of that as well. And this is the thing. I was trying to work out the calculation. Does it sometimes think, though, that the good stuff outweighs all that?
Most plays are bad because most everything is bad. Most music is bad. Most TV is bad. But you don't watch it all. You don't watch the stuff that doesn't personally interest you and that you don't kind of know will be good or think will be good. But when you're a reviewer and you kind of have to give everything a chance, you don't have that luxury. You see absolutely everything. So most people if they see 5-6 plays a year, they will mainly be good. And usually because someone like me or maybe just friends or another viewer has kind of has kind of told them what it is and if it's any good or not. But like I go and have to go to the stuff that's terrible, like, as well. And I don't bring plus ones to that stuff. When I kind of have a guess and I'm like, no, I'll go anyway because maybe this is great and, you know, maybe it's a new company and maybe they're actually something special and you do find those people. But I'm not going to inflict it on someone else if it's, you know, a 3.5-hour vanity project. So, yeah.
Okay, so before you stop kind of hanging in the stalls then, what did you see this year that stood out for you?
Theatre-wise, so The Father at the Gate was brilliant. It's a French play and it was obviously translated, but it's about a man with Alzheimer's, and I think often the story of Alzheimer's is really difficult to get from the sufferer's perspective because they don't remember and the memory's not working and they don't really realise what they're going through. So we always see it from the family and the friends. So, like, you know, there was Still Alice, the Julianne Moore, which was really good, and there was Elizabeth Is Missing, a book a couple of years ago about a woman with Alzheimer's, who are really good. But they're always, they try to get into that, to the mind of the person suffering, but you end up really just empathizing for the family and not for the person. But The Father was brilliant because it really put you inside the head. So it was Owen Rowe playing this man who in his 60s with Alzheimer's, and they did wonderfully because they played the scenes out of order in the play. So, like, it was how he would remember it, you know, and he would say, oh, but that already happened, or that hasn't happened yet. And then you were like, because you were going, no, wait, this doesn't make sense. Or brilliantly, his daughter was a constant. She was his carer, sort of. And they got a different actress halfway through out of nowhere to play the daughter. So we're going, that's not his daughter. Like, absolutely, that's not his daughter, because he's going, you're not my daughter. But obviously she is. So I thought that was absolutely brilliant. Really, really great. And I there's a load of 1916 stuff this year. And like Little was awful, but Little was brilliant either, because it's very prescriptive. I really don't agree with that. Like, there was loads of extra arts funding, 22 million this year for 1916 projects. But specifically, and I don't think you should be telling artists so specifically what they should be creating. I mean, naturally, it might start to feed into the work because they're aware of it. But like, that to me feels like the business of art, you know? Mm. And so, but there were like Signatories was a great project, how many Signatories were there?
Seven.
Yeah. And then they had Elizabeth O'Farrell as well. That was the, like, hit and miss, but was a different playwright wrote a monologue for each of the Signatories, and that was put on Comenham Jail. But my favourite of that was Colin Murphy did Inside the GPO, and he actually staged it inside the GPO, which was just a brilliant experience, to go in there. And what else was really?
Speaking of kind of like site specific stuff, did you go to the new production in these rooms?
Yeah, I did.
Did you think it was up to the mark?
Or do you think they were
jogging on the spot?
Well, so with the Anu Productions, for anyone that hasn't been, it's like you go into the building. It's very site specific, very immersive, and you're often just you on your own, or you might be an audience of two or three, and then there might be three actors at you. So the group I was divided into, something went wrong, and we ended up seeing going into the same room a couple of times, and I missed a lot of the building. So for me, that was sort of disappointing, and I think they probably should have had that more in order, but I think that was probably a rarity and most people did get to go around the buildings. Yeah, I thought it was good. It's not my favourite piece of theirs that I've seen. They did one in Magdalen Laundries a few years ago.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely one of the best things I've ever seen in Ireland or anywhere. But yeah.
Do you think as well, I mean, like the other thing, I suppose the other big theatre announcement lately was the kind of like the new Lads in the Abbey were announcing their programme for the coming months. You know, what do you make of that? And you think the kind of like that's kind of what they announced as well had a big bang of waking the feminists to it as well.
Yeah.
They finally took notice of who was in the audience and what the work they wanted to see.
Well, if there was any sector like that was sort of newsworthy, particularly in the arts in Ireland this year, it was theatre. And like, it ends with the new guys at the Abbey, but it began with Waking the Feminists, which is, to me, is the most successful artist movement that I've ever seen in Ireland. Like, we have artists, there is a national campaign for the arts and stuff, which is good. And actually this year also kind of showed its abilities to make change when we didn't have a Department of Arts for a while and then we did again. But they haven't always been very effective. And I think like a lot of the artist thing is about inward looking, and sometimes it can be hard to get a collective together. Waking the Feminist thing was just brilliant. At the beginning, I was dubious because it started as a hashtag. And I really thought, like, I don't see a hashtag. hashtag changing the world. But they actually did. Like, I mean, they had influence that was picked up in New York, and theatres in New York, theatres in Canada, theatres in London were holding symposiums about it to look at themselves and how could they get more women involved. And it was, what was brilliant as well was they just wrapped it up last month. Like, no nonsense. It was a year. And they really made change. And the biggest change that they got was the Abbey, the new guys, Neil Murray and Graham McLaren, who are Welsh and Scottish and have just come from the National Theatre in Scotland and are taking over from Fiac in the Abbey. They committed to, over any five-year period, so they're saying from 2016 to 2020, having 50-50 gender equality, which is, I don't know how they're going to do it, but I believe that they will, and they will really try. But that's everything. Like, that's not just about playwrights. That's about the actors on the stage. So they're saying, like, half the characters are going to be women, and thus half the actors. Like, that's around about half, you know, 50. And it goes everything into, like, even into areas that are dominated by women, like costume design, you know, and stuff like that. So, like, that's amazing change. And the thing, I felt sorry and for Fiac MacNeil, and think he got a hard time on that, because he was called out and he dealt with it. He had 10 plays for the 1916 programme, and only one was by a woman. Whereas Michael Colgan, who's been sitting at the gate like Mugabe, not giving over control for the last 33 years. That's satire now, if anyone's going to sue me. But
This has been recorded for podcast, and please note that Edna Shortall said that in a satirical manner.
That is a little image I constantly have of. Anyway, but he has been there for 33 years and he's leaving now. And he, in the 33 years that he was there, he did not put on one single original play by an Irish woman. Not one at any point. He did a couple by international women and a couple of adaptations by Irish women. I think there was a touring show or something, but he himself didn't put on it. I mean, that's disgraceful. And
he was never. Well, he was never. All, like, this is one thing that kind of struck me as well. Not being a theatre buff, but retrospectively looking at his work, as you just kind of pointed out, there was a very serious gender shift there. Mm. Why wasn't he called out that before?
I know. Well, why wasn't he called out even after the Wake and the Feminist thing? Marion Finucane had him on, anyway, to talk about Wake and the Feminist.
Hang on a second. You can't slag off Marion Finucane because you were a guest on the show last week.
What does that mean? That I love
well, you were, you're now you're no, now part not... of that cosy circle.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay.
We'll park that one.
I was actually on for, this side note, but I was on Marion Finucane last again, and I on the panel, which I was excited about because I'd never been on the show, but like,
Jesus,
I was so young and so, I felt like a little whippersnapper, like, you know, like I was really bringing down the demographic. And they even said afterwards, they're like, well, we'll have you on again. It's great to have a young woman. And I was like, yeah, grand, I'll tick that box. But like, you know, you never realise like how, not that there's anything wrong with being old, but they could just do it a bit of range, you know. And I didn't realise till I was actually sitting there and I was like, oh, right. And when the conversation went to social media, I was like, oh, no.
Let's get back to Colgan.
Sorry, yes, back to Colgan. So Colgan was on, and it's not a problem with the Marion Finucane show, and I'm not just saying that, I actually love Marion Finucane, I love that show, but they had him on, like, right after Waking the Feminist happens. I just don't think he was the right person to have on to be talking about Waking the Feminist, and they asked him about it. He didn't even go to the first meeting, but they asked him about it, and he talked about it, and it was mainly like, I thought they would have left a seat for me at the Abbey, and they hadn't, and so he didn't go. But he talked about that, but no one said to him, well, what about your own record, you know? So even after the Wigan Feminist, I wrote about it a bit, and then he was called up on it a little bit later, but anyway, that just has to change. You just can't do that. And so Selena Cartmell's taking over in the Gate now, so that's been announced as well. So that's huge. Like, they're the two biggest theatres, not just in Dublin but in Ireland, and a change. And so, sorry, to come back to the new guys at the Abbey, so yeah, they put out their first programme last week, which I thought is really great, really interesting programme. It's completely different. Like, there's no Sean O'Casey, no Singh, no Shakespeare, very few dead men in general. And they're doing like really quick turnover. So usually it's 7 shows, it's 14 shows now, and they're going for a different audience, definitely a slightly younger audience as well. I mean, I don't know how some of the things will work. Like, they're doing stage adaptation of films, so they're doing an adaptation of Jimmy's Hall, Room, and then Let the Right One In, which has already been done, but they're bringing it in. They're also doing things like, they're bringing Roddy Doyle's 2 Pints series. They're doing that in pubs around the country. Roddy Doyle gets a hard time, which I don't think is justified, but I think that's great because it's taken it out of Dublin, and like, I think maybe there might be a problem around the whole drink culture of Ireland and putting it in pubs, but like, like that will be an audience that doesn't go to the theatre but will go to the pub, and it is worth doing it in small venues and for people that are somewhat isolated in terms of getting to the theatre, and so I think that's a great idea. Right.
You said there about, like, you know, a lot of new programmes is in the Abbey is about getting younger audiences in, getting a new audience in. I mean, this is one of my other problems with theatre. A lot of the kind of like the theatre that goes on, you mentioned there the Dead Men Syndrome, you know, a lot of the plays are just reenactments of stuff from before, the classics. I know that has to be done, but it just strikes me that, like, a lot of people in theatre land seem quite conservative when it comes to them, quite guarding their own bailiwick. They don't want to, like, bring out new in, they don't want to try out new.
The argument would be that the Abbey is the National Theatre, and so its kind of specific remit somewhat is to play the canon and to celebrate the canon. And, like, they have done that. They are putting on plays from the canon. They're just not the ones we usually see. So, like, you know, this year we had Plough and the Stars and Juno and the Peacock in the Gate in the Abbey, and, like, I mean, they've both been on the last couple of years, but they are in the big theatres. Like, we go outside the big theatres and they are doing different things, but they don't have as much money. Like, I mean, if you want to put money into a production, it kind of has to be staged at the Abbey, and then that's sort of it, you know?
Yeah, which brings us neatly around to, like, me, what you mentioned earlier on, which is the Department of the Arts, which is now called what again?
Department. You wrote it down
because it's the only way we can remember it.
Yeah,
and this is the second name it had this year.
I write it all the time and I still forget. So originally, when the government formed in February, it was the Department of Regional Development, Rural Affairs, Arts and the Gaeltacht. So that is not a Department of Arts, that is the Department of Regional Development. And now it has the catchy name of Department of Arts, Heritage, Regional, Rural and Gaeltacht Affairs. Whatever you have in yourself.
Okay, so that shows a kind of, first of all, it shows a carelessness that they kind of downplayed the arts.
But
it's just
they don't care as well. Like, it's so, just
totally.
Not, it's
but
just
like, not the, but like, I mean, they responded to the criticism they got by changing the name. And I'm just kind of going, you just change the name. Nothing else really changes. Do you think Heather Humphreys has any scintilla of real interest or real will to do anything with the arts?
I would imagine it's not a major interest of hers, no. And this may be cynical, but I felt like when she was appointed arts minister, it was more about giving her profile because she was, she had just about, I can't remember the exact votes, but she just about got in her constituency, and give her profile and have a better chance of being returned. Also, he did need to have more women, again, in his cabinet, so that was part of it. I feel sorry for her, though, because often I feel like she's just put out there a poem, but she's not really making, like, I think a lot of stuff that's gone wrong for her was at a more senior level than that, was at a top of the party level, you know. And I'm not saying she's not interested in the arts, and maybe she is, and I think I think she's done well in the last couple of months because she just kind of has stood up for herself a bit more and, like, doesn't just, you know, agree with everything that is said, and especially from other artists. So I mean, like, maybe things will turn, but I wouldn't blame her, but I would just say the Fine Gael in general are not interested in the arts.
Okay, which leads with Fianna Fáil, which is a great prospect altogether. let's move swiftly along into something else. Let's move on to books. What books stood out for you this year? We're mostly kind of Irish focused.
Because most of the stuff I'm doing is Irish focused. But, like, I was going through the list because all the lists are coming out now, you know, of best books, and I feel like all I did all year was read, and yet when I look at the list, I'm like, I haven't read any of them. Like, it's just constantly, and I get books delivered to work, come in the post every single day, and my whole, it's like I sit on my computer and day by day they just go up and up, and they start to, like, eat me, you know. And it's just like the guilt of the books I will never read, you know. They're just surrounding me.
So Donald Trump has a wall, and you've got a wall as well.
Yeah, so I wrote down a few. I actually read a lot, but anyway. I also have a thing of, because I read so much for work, that when I read for pleasure, which I could never do before, but now, when I don't like a book, I will just stop reading it. Like, I give it, like, 80 pages, 100 pages, and then I don't keep going. Solar Bones, thought was great. Really thought The Lesser Bohemians, Emer McBride's follow-up, was a lovely book. I loved Graham Norton's Holding. I thought it was like a big blanket. And the interesting thing with that is, obviously Graham Norton's a massive star in the UK. Like, he's Irish, but he's been there so long that he's half there as well. His book, it hasn't charted at all in any of the charts, like paper, book, fiction, whatever, like the different stuff in the UK, but it's been top of the Irish chart, occasionally losing out to Paul O'Connell's autobiography for weeks and weeks. Like, he's really done well here. Like, he's selling thousands of copies every week.
Did it surprise you? I mean, that what surprised me was that book got riveting, really great reviews.
I loved it. Yeah. I thought it was a lovely book. It's kind of like The Famous Five for adults. That's how I felt. Like, not necessarily the story, but that feeling that you get, you know, from a book. Like, it's kind of lovely. And even though, like, it's a kind of a whodunit. So there is a murder, but there's no real violence. And it was sort of like, in the times we live in, it was sort of enjoyable to really, to escape into it. And it felt like escapism. And yeah, I just kind of lapped it up. Kind of other books that were like that was The Real Liddy James, which is by Anne-Marie Casey, and who has done a couple of adaptations at the Gate. So she, the kind of occasional bit of work there.
Yeah.
And she's brilliant. They're brilliant. And I think this book is really good. Lying in Wait, which was Liz Nugent's crime book. And then The Bricks That Built the Houses, Kate Tempest. Like, I could go on forever.
Yeah.
The Samuel Beckett Personal Letters was probably my favourite book this year. All his letters have been released in four tranches. And so this is the last one. So it's the last years of his life. Like, if there's an award for editor, like the kind of that almost academic level of editing that I don't know if one exists, but they should get it. There are four editors. And these aren't like... They're not letters sent to him, so it's not like they had them all in the one place. They went out into the world to everyone he wrote it, to the families, into the archives, whatever, and they found all his letters. And the ones he wrote in French are in French and then in English, and they have annotations to kind of tell you what's going on. It's really interesting. The stuff about his play called Play was put on in the Abbey, and he went to see it and thought it was terrible, and he's right about this, and he hated it. And then they want to do Waiting for Godot, and they want to put Peter O'Toole in it, and he's like, no way, and he's not a Peter O'Toole fan, and he doesn't want them doing that. But then his agent in the UK goes and just gives them the rights anyway, and he's like, oh, they just, you know, Curtis Brown just gave it away or whatever, and he's writing about the various reports. But the best thing is that he wins the Nobel Prize during this time, and he does not want to win the Nobel Prize. Like, he's sending his French editor up to Sweden to put the word about that he doesn't want it, you know, like, thanks very much, but I don't want the prize. And then he gets it, and he's like, fuck's sake. Well, he didn't say that, much more elegantly spoken. But he's like, I can't believe it, now I'm going to have to deal with this. And so then he legs it off to Tunisia, or is it Morocco? Tunisia or Morocco? And he's in North Africa to get away from it, but the Swedish media follow him. And then he says, he talks about how the Arabs are helping him out and hiding him away. All this. Like, it's... They're brilliant, yeah.
Really. Okay, do you think we ever see kind of like books being made of people's emails? Your emails to your agent's emails back to you.
They're not. I need to start putting a bit more effort into it. I think when you write a letter, though, you do put more effort in than you put into an email. So I don't think they'd be of the same caliber.
Yeah.
But I mean, people do still write letters, you know. Like, not many, but like probably people that are very into writing. So I don't see why that couldn't be possible.
You mentioned Solar Bones. I mean, that was a cracking book, and I've noticed it's turning up on loads of lists as well. You know, it was really kind of a vindication of Mike Cormack. He took his time over it, and like, it's a powerful book. It got at the Court Festival back in April. He read and. Like, often when an author reads from their work, you get it. And he read, this was before it was being published, you could hear a pin drop in the room, and like, he's just a powerful reader. I mean, do you think that's the kind of book that's going to get him a lot of international attention that might have escaped up to now?
Yeah, I mean, he's had no international attention up to now. He was a real writer's writer, and you know, people that were very into Irish fiction read him. But I mean, he found it difficult to get published, and you know, he was really struggling. And then Tramp Press took this on. They're great. Like, they're two women, Lisa Cohen and Sarah Goff, and they put it out, and like, they're a small two-person operation working out of Dublin, and it won the Goldsmith Prize, you know, and like, they've had a massive amount of success. And so a lot of that, like, he wrote the book, but giving him a platform was down to them and kind of taking that chance. I think that'll be picked up to be published elsewhere, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like, winning prizes is great for that kind of thing, you know. It's like the Goldsmith, which is a real like prize that other publishers will be looking at.
Totally. I mean, that brings me on to kind of the idea of prize. I can't remember if it was you or John Burns.
No, John Burns.
Wrote about this, you know, and it just seems to be that there's prizes for everything. You mentioned there the editors who put together Samuel Beckett's prize. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a prize for that as well.
Mm.
I mean, how important do you think it is for Irish writers, especially, that those prizes exist as a platform?
Yeah, for Irish literary fiction, it's massive, you know, and maybe it shouldn't be, you know, but they've always been there are so many books produced. Like, I see them coming in my desk, and so people are just looking for a way to know which is the best one. But there was a point, so that was in The Culture last week, my boss wrote it, and he quoted Rob Doyle in it, who was saying that often books that win prizes just continue to win prizes, you know, and I think that's definitely the case. Like, that people just don't bother to look beyond it, you know. If they're going to vote, they go, oh, well, maybe I didn't get to read everything, but I heard this one is great, you know, and so then it can just be a cycle. And so great for that one book that got picked up, but there's loads of other ones along the way that just didn't get a look in. So,
okay, let's move on from books and let's move to film.
Yes.
I mean, Room ended up kind of like in the Oscars.
Yeah.
Amy Emerson got, like, I mean, to get the Tuxedo to Dry Cleaners and got a date at the Oscars. What, like, I mean, obviously that film stands out. What other Irish films stood out this year?
So, just on Room, just the thing I say there is that, this year there were 9 Irish nominations at the Oscars, which is the highest we've ever had, and we only won one, which was Benjamin Cleary's short film, but. Like, it was, people really did take notice, and I think, like, we will continue. I'd be very surprised if we don't get any nominations this year. And I think the most likely nomination is Sing Street, probably best song from that. So yeah. That did really well. It did critically really well. It got released in the States, but it didn't, like, it was, the Americans particularly loved it, but it just didn't quite find its audience.
The other Irish person probably get a nomination is Ruth Negga, you know, and
yes,
she's
yes,
like,
loving.
Absolutely
yeah.
powerful. Yeah, powerful in that.
Yeah, that's, Jeff Nichols film about a couple in
Maryland
Virginia?
1950s Virginia, yeah.
Virginia, yeah. White man, black woman, and it were interracial marriages were illegal at the time. So, but actually, Jeff Nichols had Midnight Special was out this year, which I loved. Wasn't Irish, but it was absolutely brilliant. Michael Shannon. Irish films. Room was the best performing box office Irish film this year until now. The Young Offenders overtook it, which is the Cork kind of buddy caper where they. Two teenagers go off and find, or looking for heroin that's washed up on the coast of Cork, and has PJ Gallagher as a cameo in it. And that's a low budget film, and it's kind of travel the best.
I'm fairly sure that's kind of like going to get a release abroad as well. So
they've got a distribution deal for Australia and I can't remember, but yeah, for a few countries. A Day for Mad Mary was it my personal favorite Irish film of the year? Maybe. It's thought that was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And I went to see that twice, and that started as a play, actually, and then just got adapted and they kind of made some changes to it, whatever. And that was Shauna Kerslake was in that as well, and she's had a great year because she was in Can't Cope, Won't Cope too.
Okay.
Which was the same
you mentioned Midnight Special there. I mean, what were other international films that kind of hit you in the eyes?
American Honey. I saw
great.
Recently. I loved it.
I loved it.
A big thing with reviewing, especially theatre, is I hate stuff that's too long. Almost everything's too long, you know. And when you're over 3 hours, I don't care if you're Shakespeare. Keep it to 3 hours, you know.
Yeah.
But American Honey was about 3 hours, and I wanted more. I was like, I want to live in this world for longer. I thought it was gorgeous. Arrival, did you see that?
Yeah, I saw it last week.
Yeah.
I love the music. I love the music.
Well, that's very faint praise.
I know. I left the cinema kind of going that Max Richter, I've got to get that Max Richter track again. You know, that was fantastic. I thought it was good, but I'd seen Patterson the night before, the new Jim Jarmusch film, and that blew me away.
Reviews of that are great, but people I know that have seen it have said it is not great. So
are you saying that reviewers and people are two separate species?
Well, sometimes if something got a great review, it might just continue to get a great review. I don't know. I can be a little bit sceptical about certain kinds of films, but I don't know.
Let's move swiftly on before we've a heated debate up here. Let's move on to music. We're here with our voices.
Yeah,
let's talk Irish music first of all.
Well, actually, I'd say music is terrible. It's the worst thing I know. It's at a music festival, but I consume so much stuff across different genres, and music is the one in the last couple of years that has really started to lose out. I don't know if it's an age thing or do you reach a certain age where your ability to take in new music and get excited by new music, and it still happens, but it just doesn't happen to me at the same rate that it used to happen when I was 20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And so you kind of pushing yourself. Another thing was that Beyonce released Lemonade, and then I just listened to that for the rest of the year. I listen to that several times a week, every week. It's my I Feel Down song. It's a I'm Going Out song. It's my Run song. You know, absolutely everything. So that was it's kind of got in the way of a lot of other stuff. But things I did actually listen to. Bar Solange, I did move away from that a bit.
So it's just an old family.
It was a great year for All Twins, I'd say that.
Yeah.
They're selling out the Olympia, which is it's incredible. I think they're great. The Russin Gang.
Russin Gano family, yeah.
Family. Yeah. Saw some last night. I listened to them a lot. What other Irish stuff did I don't know, you tell me, what did you?
Well, I thought the Bill Ice album was fantastic. I thought it was kind of a career high. I liked the Caddy Davey album as well. I thought that was really strong.
Elisa Hannigan's album.
I started listening to that lately again. Yeah. But the album that kind of just blew me away. And again, it's just I know my editor's left town, so I can say this, It's the end of year list drive me ballistic, because always what'll happen is when you have a list sent in, an album will land on your desk and you go, fuck, this is incredible. Like Quivi and O'Reilly, who played here
post-list.
Yesterday. Yeah, post list. Okay. Post list. It's an album of Terry McMahon. it's kind of like the last album from him, really, is Concertina Player. It is beautiful. If you want an amazing trad album, that album, go and check that one out. That's incredible.
You tell me, because you're better placed. What was your album of the year?
Anson Paak, Malibu. It stood out a mile. This is the guy that the BBC are saying is the sound of 2017. This is a dude who released an album in 2015.
Did you not 2015? Write something saying the BBC's sound of thing is not a good idea?
Yeah, I did. And I just need to be very careful here. Is Hugh Stevens at the back of the room still? He's there, okay. He's gone, is he? Oh, I see him, Hugh. Okay, like I don't know. Hugh's in the BBC, and Hugh already chastised me slightly about this yesterday. He didn't chastise me; he kind of mentioned it to me. But like, I just think it sucked. I mean, it's this idea.
But you just said your favorite album was there.
But the point is, he's down on their list as an artist to watch in 2017. Etna, he released his debut album. He released his debut album in 2015.
Okay,
he collaborated on the Dre album in 2015. He released an amazing album, his own album, this year, 2016. He also released another album in 2016. He's been on millions of collaborations. It just kind of struck me as really stupid that all these tastemakers were saying that the dude who's produced the album in 2016 is going to be the sound of 2017. See, I get really upset about things like that. I get upset about the fact that everyone's
going
to
have a hobby.
It's sad. I need to get out more. I get kind of really annoyed that I'm seeing all these people that I really admire, people like Kitty Empire, going on about how their album of the year is Christine the Queen's album, and that album was released last year. Just
But this happens on the books thing, because like books, they take so long and they come out and you don't always read them the year they came out, you know. So a lot of the books I would like to put down for 2016 had actually come out in 2015 and stuff. But just on the prizes thing, like I was talking about this last night. Like, so with the big prizes in Ireland, like you have the Irish Book Awards, you have the IFTAs, I don't know. It's not completely transparent how the voting for those works. Like, it's not completely known how it works, right? I've voted in both. I just think the Choice Prize is brilliant because it's everyone in that room really loves music, the 10 judges or whatever. They sit around, they have a big heated debate. It's not like it's a quiet ballad. And then they come to a consensus on an album. And I think it's the most transparent and kind of from the heart prize that we have, you know.
It was designed to be so. I mean, Declaration of Interest, I was involved in setting it up. And
I realise now, I didn't mean to compliment you. Damn it.
But that was the whole idea for Nanette then. Just make it so transparent. You couldn't mess with it. It's very simple. Here are the 12 judges. Here are their names. These are the albums they voted for. They're in the room. They decide on the night. Simple as that, you know. And when you said there about the other prizes that there's kind of like question marks over, you know. I mean, I've heard that.
I'm not saying there's anything going on. Like, I believe in what they do, but I just don't know 100% how it works.
Yeah.
You know?
Would you think, you know, and like, you know, you don't have names. Do you think, like, I mean, let's say when it comes to awards like those Irish book prizes, that publishers might have an undue influence over what gets on it? Let us know for the purpose of the podcast. That
I think there's often a prize for no publisher maybe is left completely empty handed.
Okay,
yeah,
that's a very fair way.
Maybe I don't know.
Okay. So that's music. That's music, books, film, theatre. I want to talk a little bit about you, it struck me earlier on when you were talking about theatre, and you kind of mentioned all the Dublin places like the Gate and Abbey. And let's move outside of Dublin, since we're in Dingle.
My favourite theatre in Ireland, like as a building and to just sit in and watch, is the Lyric in Belfast. I think it's absolutely gorgeous building. They won architecture awards. And they have a really interesting programme. And one of my highlights of the year was there, Educating Rita, which was, okay, everyone probably knows the film, and, you know, about this, it's filmed in Trinity, I think, but about a girl, and she's got this real heavy Liverpool accent, and it's kind of like Pygmalion, you know, when the professor sort of teaches her how to speak, how to read and educates her in English literature. But they did that, and they just moved it to Belfast. Instead of her being Liverpool, she was Belfast. Very subtle, kind of small changes, and sometimes that can feel a bit gimmicky and kind of cringeworthy, but it worked brilliantly. And Kerry Quinn was Rita in that, and she's amazing. And she doesn't really seem to play as much outside Belfast, but I think she should be. She'll be on all stages. She'll be on screen.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of other plays I saw up there that were too inward looking, and like a problem with Ireland is small, and we sort of are a bit obsessed with ourselves. And then I think Northern Ireland's even smaller and can be even more so. You know, and so two productions I saw that were they didn't need to be about the Troubles, but ended up being about the Troubles. So they did a production of Three Sisters, Chekhov, and they made nothing to do with the story, but they have the Troubles going on outside the door throughout. It's kind of annoying. They also commissioned a new play, Rosemary Jenkins, and it's new theatre. Like, there's a new, like people in the north, they have a lot of family and friends there, and like, they're moving on. It's not a big thing for them, and yet they commissioned a new play, and the first half of the play is set in the 60s, and it's about the Troubles again, you know. And I just feel like The Fall is the only kind of art outwork I can see that can make something in contemporary Belfast and not make it all about the Troubles. I mean, they barely come into that.
And what do you think that comes down to? Does that come down to the commissioners, or does that come down to the actual...
Yeah, I think it's being afraid to try something new, maybe, and knowing what sells. And also, it's ready-made conflict, and you need conflict in a story,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, but like me, okay, so that's it from your perspective as a critic. You know, what about audiences? Do you think, I mean, audiences in Belfast especially are ready for kind of like, I mean, post-conflict stuff? I mean, are they gagging for it? Yeah. They don't want to get over it and just move on.
There are post-conflict... Owen McCafferty had a play recently, and it was a few years ago, but he's written a lot about around the Troubles, and this is post-Troubles and has this new sort of sectarianism that is about Eastern Europeans versus the indigenous people, yeah, or whatever, and that is post-Troubles but still manages to somewhat be about the Troubles, you know, and that works. So I mean, I that did really well.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, there are lots of things put on there that aren't about the Troubles, but I just think still proportionately there's too much, and I think people there want to move on, so I think the artwork has to move on to reflect that as well.
Okay, you mentioned The Fall there. I mean, do you get much time to watch TV, and what stood out for you?
Yeah, so I like The Fall. The last season got really slow, just lots of long lingering shots of hospital beds.
But that same thing, it's really funny, my favourite TV series of the year was the Night Of. And it was just amazing, amazing. And everyone was criticizing it that I recommended to say it was too slow. And like, same thing with The Fall, people thought it's really, really slow. But like, after I watched 3 episodes of The Fall, it wasn't the fact it was slow that was the problem. It's the fact that it wasn't very good. It just ran out of steam.
But sometimes people can say slow and they mean nothing happens. And, you know, and they can kind of different things. I think The Fall is slow, but it's not bad as a result of being that. Can't Cope, Won't Cope was a big thing because, or on RT2, and I didn't always work. I thought the first couple of episodes were great, and then it kind of it was good throughout, but the beginning was the strongest. But no matter what, I'm just so glad that got made and they put it on TV and they gave some people a chance and a different story, and people really responded to that, you know.
And it's like, spread in Republic of Tilly.
Huh?
It was buried in the Republic of Tilly.
I don't know. Apparently that's been cancelled now. So,
oh, fantastic.
That's finished. So, but Brian, I just read a story today that Brian McFadden is delighted it's been cancelled. I think they slagged him off a few times. So,
shite, I don't like being...
He took to Twitter to tell everyone how he was delighted it had been cancelled. Kind of Irish stuff. Cutting Edge, the Brendan O'Connor show. I can't believe it works, but it works. It's like a radio show on TV. Yeah. It's just people sitting there talking, but it's very good. And I have a problem that Brendan O'Connor seems to just have other Dennis O'Brien employees on the panel. There's an awful lot of journalists that also work for the Sunday Independent and News Talk, and I don't know, it seems like a slight conflict of interest to me. But bar that, like, I think that's a great show that worked really well. And like, I voted this year in the IFTTTs for the TV entertainment category, and that was my vote. Pat Kenny started his show on TV3 as a rival to it. Pat Kenny Tonight with Colette Fitzpatrick. I mean, this is just like insult in the title. So that wasn't a good start. And that they got a bad time about that. And the viewing...
But leaving aside the bad time they got over, that's stupidity. I mean, the idea of Pat Kenny doing a kind of a show like that just doesn't work anymore. Because when he did The Frontline on RT, it was just...
It was very like The Frontline.
Yeah, it's very like Frontline. Mm-hmm. It was like an angry man. Okay, he can be occasionally very angry, as a previous banter guest owner, Bryn, found out last week and he challenged him by the water charges. It's really funny that they're trying people like him. All the names they're trying for TV programs, people like Brendan O'Connor, people that have been around the block before.
Yeah, but Brendan O'Connor has only really been a staple of TV for the last couple of years, though. He's been around as a journalist, but I mean, when he had a Saturday night show, but that was only the last few years. I know, Pat Kenny obviously been around for a long time, but he's good at what he does. But the viewership figures aren't there. Like, I was looking at the figures the last few weeks, and it's not doing well. And there are weeks when Vincent Brown on a Tuesday night is doing better than Pat Kenny on Wednesday. So it doesn't seem to quite be working audience-wise yet. But Gilmore Girls, I'll just bring it down a bit. Gilmore Girls, I look forward to for pretty much all of the year. And it kind of was disappointing, but I was just glad to have them all back. And also to have it back on Netflix. I was thinking of 1916 stuff. Rebellion
Third year.
Yeah, and which did well at the beginning and then wasn't so good towards the end and kind of viewership fell off. But they've made a second season and that's coming back. But that got a co-production deal with Sundance TV in America, so they're also kind of footing half of the bill for that. There was Trial of the Century. Did you see that on TV3?
No.
It was about the trial. It was like, what if Padraig Pearse had actually stood trial and hadn't been executed? And then they had a real jury of people that made the decision about it. It was a really interesting idea. And they had Reckon the Rising on TG Carrie. Tisha Cara makes brilliant dramas and they just never get the audience. That was really good. Klondike I thought was great, which they put on and now it's coming back for a second season as well, so I thought it was great. I don't know. And then there are the shows everyone says are great but I didn't see, like Divorce and The Affair, and I'm sure they are.
Yeah, and I'd add Rectify That, which I saw, which is excellent, and Billions was great.
Did you see Westworld?
Is Westworld kind of some kind of like surreal kind of fancy thing like Lord of the Flies or Lord of the Rings?
I don't know.
Sorry, not my cup of tea. There's certain different blanks. And the other thing that blew me away was Atlanta, Donald Glover, Childish Gambino's hip-hop series. Paperboy, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's bring it all back home then. One last section, which is festivals. We were starting to kind of ramble there. I was kind of talking about stuff outside Dublin. And like I'm curious from your point of view, as kind of like an arts critic, do you think things like, say, the Kilkenny Arts Festival, Galway Arts Festival, do you think those things are still on the calendar because they've always been on the calendar, or are they still capable of producing great work?
I think over the last kind of 5 or 6 years where I've been going to a lot of stuff like that, the Galway Arts Festival is the best arts festival in Ireland. Like, it just, they put on really interesting new works on a really big scale. It's small enough. They use different venues already in the city. Galway obviously has a great arts reputation. I think that's brilliant. Kilkenny is catering for an audience. Like, it's more sort of towards classical music and an audience that aren't catered for in most festivals. So I think that will continue to survive. Huge growth in literary festivals, like constantly. Yeah. But there's a demand for them. It never seems to fall away. I think more people must go to festivals, book festivals, than actually read books. Yeah. You know, they must, because they don't reflect like the many people going in with sales necessarily. And like, I go to talks of authors I haven't read. So, I am just interested. Yeah.
It's interesting. I remember talking to Penny Hart from Arena, and she was saying that the topics that get most coverage from them and get the most reaction from them are book items. That they're ahead of cinema, way ahead of music. You know, we want to hear from authors.
But like, I mean, you say cheesy things are always said about Irish people, and it's very hard to say anything about it. Nation and stuff, but we do like we value storytelling or appreciate it, or you know, respect it is probably the term, you know. So even if you don't read the book, you respect that someone wrote a story and you want to hear them talk, you know. Isn't that great?
Last question then for me, you know, and you can answer this from a personal point of view. What are you looking forward to in 2017? Is there a book coming out?
My book is coming out in June, but that is not on my list of things. It should be. So I wrote down loads of stuff, just so I won't forget them. Okay, so there is a documentary called In Loco Parentis, which is, what's her name? Nasani Keenan. She did Fairy Tale of Kathmandu, that kind of controversial Kahalu Sharkic documentary. But it's about, it's just starting to play festivals internationally. It's getting really good reviews and kind of word of mouth. It's the last boarding school for primary school students in Ireland. It's in Headford in Kells, or near Kells. No, it's a smaller place near Kells in Meath. And so fascinating. She got really good access, and she goes in, and like, these people aren't just teachers, they're parents, because these kids are coming in at 4 and 5, you know, and then they're there throughout. And apparently that's brilliant. So I'm really looking forward to that. The National Museum and the National Gallery is going to reopen. It was meant to reopen a year ago. It's been closed for the year with only a couple of like small bit, which is pretty disgraceful, I think, especially in the centenary year when they're trying to get people to come in, and then our main gallery isn't open, you know, and Emma had closures as well. So, but anyway, that reopens, and they have a Beyond Caravaggio exhibition, which they're sharing with London. That'll be big. We have this one Caravaggio, which I love, and which we're always talking about, but this will be more Caravaggio, so that's good. And then there's a Margaret Clark exhibition, who is Harry Clark of the Stained Glass Windows, which are just around the corner here as well. His wife, who was a great artist, didn't get a lot of coverage. She's going to have a show, or like, obviously she's dead, but a retrospective. I'm really interested to see the Room adaptation at the Abbey, how that works. I think that'd be great. They're also putting on a play by Teresa Devey. So Teresa Devey was a Waterford playwright, and in the 30s, she was as big as Lennox Robinson, everyone else around. She was deaf, which is really interesting for some creating something to be heard. And she, when she like I don't know, the Abbey kind of took a very conservative turn sort of in later years, and they just wrote her out of it, and she was completely forgotten. And nobody really knew who she was. And then in New York a few years ago, the Mint Theatre put on this play, Katie Roach, which was her best known play. I've been wanting to see it ever since they did it, and so the Abbey are now doing that next year, so that'd be great. Loving the Ruth Negga film that we were talking about. Kevin Barry has his first film, it's called Autumn Royal, and it's going to be on in Cork, and then I think it's turned to a project in Dublin and elsewhere. Laura Marling has a new album, which I just always look forward to. Emma Donoghue is writing her first kids' books called The Lotteries, and it sounds great. It's about a family of, it's not your traditional family, same-sex parents, or maybe two different same-sex couples, can't remember, interracial, blah, 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 and their bigoted granddad comes to stay and they have to convince. I think that's a bit cool. The Secret Scripture, which isn't getting good reviews, the film adaptation, but I'm very interested to see it.
Yeah.
Apparently it's not at all like the book. But that got delayed. There were issues with, like, I think there was bankruptcy for their distribution company, and that was meant to be out this year as well, so that's going out next year. Striking Out is Amy Huberman's new show on RTE, which I'm really curious, and the second season of On Klondike. And then a book called Love in Row 27, which will be out in June, written by myself.
Edna Shortall, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Edna for taking the time to join us at Banter and Dingle and doing all that homework. Big thanks to Banter Other Voices producer Molly King, our super patient sound man Stephen Andrew Cuddy, and all the other voices and Foxy Johns for their help with the weekend. Banter Other Voices was a Carol King production. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another Bantercast. Until then, goodbye and take care.